Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Now, if you appreciate Issues Etc., please consider making a tax-deductible gift today. You can make a secure online contribution at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Scrape to send you to the law, to elevate you to a noble profession. I sweat in the mines for 20 years to give you the chance I never had. Is that how you interpret the commandment? To honor your father and mother?
God brought me here.
God? A shaft of lightning burns your arse and you call that God? The devil, more like.
That's a scene from the 2003 Luther movie, a confrontation between young Luther, who has celebrated his first Mass, and his father, who had hopes that he would go on to be something other than a monk or a priest. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're doing a weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation, stretching over the next couple of years, and part two is straight ahead. Dr. Ken Scherb will join us here in the first hour of the program. We're going to talk about Luther and the Church before the Reformation. That is, what was Luther doing before he was the Reformer, and what was the state of the Church at that time as well? We'll answer all those questions with Dr. Ken Scherb. He's a PhD in history from Ohio State University. A little bit later on Issues Etc., we'll spend some time with Pastor Ted Giese. We'll review the movie Spectre. It is the latest of the 007 James Bond movies, I think the last one by the current James Bond, and it's kind of the last one to complete a story of the previous movies featuring that actor. We'll talk about that and review that movie. And then Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer joins us. Our series on Christ in the Old Testament continues. We'll be in Daniel 12 talking about the time of the end, the last day and judgment with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. Our call-in number for the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, and the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 for your questions and comments, 618-223-8382. Dr. Ken Scherb is a regular guest. He's pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. He has a PhD in history from Ohio State University, formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He joins us for part two of our series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. Ken, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Glad to be here.
Ken, part of what we're doing here in this series is a pretty thorough historical treatment of Luther, and then today a little bit Luther in the Church before the Reformation. And historians seem a bit obsessed with the beginnings of things, the backgrounds of things. Why is that?
I suppose the short answer is we'd all be out of a job if we didn't do things like that. As a common sense matter, though, Todd, I mean, it is true when you get to know somebody, when you're introduced to a new person, you find out about kind of where they came from, what their background is. And that's kind of what we're doing here with Luther and the Reformation. It can become a fetish, though. One great historian in America said almost 100 years ago, you know, in the modern world, we can't tell you what anything is, but we can wax on and on about where things came from. So we have to be a little bit careful here. We have to be careful that we don't commit what even historians call the genetic fallacy, which is to figure that anyone or anything is basically no more than the sum of the various parts that went into that person or thing, the sum of the background influences and factors. Even secular historians ought to know better than to think that that's all anybody can be reduced to. And that caution certainly applies to Luther, and we'll be careful about that as we go on.
So when we began last week, you made the point that it's important for us not to miss the real Luther. How would you summarize what we said then?
Well, if people these days think that Luther is important, and of course, in a lot of cases, they don't. But if you find somebody who does know something about Luther, kind of the man in the street, and they think that Luther is important, it's often not, however, for Luther's theology. It's for something that Luther led to, or that they think Luther led to, whether it's something good that they like or something bad that they deplore. They think that Luther is important for the things that he led to. We also said last time that a stress on Luther as a religious man, a religious genius, as it were, has led to a misconception of his teaching on justification. The thought is that Luther was so religiously wrapped up in God, he didn't want to do works in order to achieve a relationship with God. He wanted to do works out of a relationship that was already there, out of love for God, and a longing for an ever more perfect righteousness in the future. But see, that already begins to give you the problem, and this is the third great point we made last time, Todd, that a distinctive earmark of the mature Lutheran doctrine of justification is that my righteousness before God is really not my own. It is alien righteousness, the righteousness of another, the righteousness of Christ.
So let's just begin at the beginning. When was Luther born? What was the time like?
Well, almost exactly 9 years before Columbus first encountered the Americas. The date was November 10th, 1483, obviously near the turn of the century. Luther was one of those kind of people born toward the turn of the century, like my kids, born toward the turn of the last century. He would live most of his life in the new century if he lived. Infant mortality was a huge factor in Luther's day. Half or more of infants died. And so there was a tremendous need to get these babies baptized, and people understood that. Luther himself was baptized the very day after he was born, which was St. Martin's Day, right, November 11th, and that's why he was named Martin Luther.
So apart from it being dangerous to come into the world that way, infant mortality, these were pretty hazardous times, weren't they?
Oh, you name it. Internationally, I mean, the Turks were on the offensive in the East, and that was just going to get worse as the 15th century turned into the 16th century. There, of course, was still the plague. The plague was a huge thing a few years before Luther was born, but it was still around, and it would still be around during his lifetime, wreaking havoc. Other kinds of disease, violence, in ways that we hardly even find feasible to think about, Todd, I think. Violence was a factor of life for people in the 16th century on a daily basis. Inflation. The population was rising in numbers, but the food supply remained relatively constant. Wages fell while prices rose. People in the 16th century were getting caught in an economic squeeze, and that had its impact, too, on the times in which Luther lived. And, of course, work, just working for a living, could be a very dangerous thing, depending upon the kind of work you were involved in. Luther's father, Hans, was a copper miner. We don't know exactly what he was doing when Luther was born. But he went into copper mining, but he managed to work his way out of the mines. He became an owner, really, of copper mining interests, and eventually a very respected member of the community, a member of the city council, in fact.
What were his ambitions for his son Martin?
Oh, Hans wanted his son Martin to become a lawyer. And that made a lot of sense in a lot of ways. It was a prudent way to think in a day and age where you didn't have insurance, where you didn't have Social Security. One's security, as it were, for one's old age lie in his offspring and what they could do. And, of course, being a lawyer would be a kind of a lucrative way of making a living. So Hans determined to send Luther to the best schools he could. He went to a couple of Latin schools. Luther later reflected, not only at home, but also in these Latin schools, how harsh the discipline had been, how he was punished for not knowing his Latin lesson on a given day. But it did its work, because eventually he was ready to matriculate to the school of St. George in Eisenach. And there, Luther's abilities began to become apparent. He was just one of the other kids for most of his what we would call elementary school years. But by the time he was 18, he showed enough promise that his dad begins to latch onto this idea of having him go on to a professional career and sends him to the University of Erfurt. And there Luther really came into his own his abilities shone. You had to be a student at Erfurt for at least a year before you could get a bachelor's degree. Well, Luther achieved his bachelor's degree in just a little over a year, in 1502. And then he got his Master of Arts degree early in 1505. Now, this was a liberal arts degree. It wasn't a degree in one particular subject. It was a broad-based degree that would prepare a student to go on and study in one of the higher faculties. There were three higher faculties: medicine, theology, and law. And Luther, of course, was preparing to go on and study in the faculty of law.
Can we tell how important the church was to Luther himself as he was growing up?
Well, just like Luther didn't really stand out as a student in his earliest years, in those same years he didn't seem remarkably or extraordinarily religious, at least not by any standard that has come down to us. But, of course, the church did have a pervasive influence in society and in the lives of people, no matter who they were at the time. One of the images that you'd see very often in churches was Christ pictured in artwork, not on a cross, but on a throne. He's the exalted Christ in this picture. And out of one side of his mouth is coming a sword, and the other side of his mouth there comes out a lily. And the question that got impressed upon Luther and lots of other people from little on up was, how do you get that lily and avoid the sword?
Well, on the other side of the break, we're going to talk a bit about the papacy. Let's get a little jump on it here, especially as it's central to the medieval church. What is the basis for the position that the Pope held within the church at the time, and especially this position that he held in the hearts of and the minds of common people?
The Pope's position was based on two premises. Number one, that the Apostle Peter had personally been given the keys by Christ. The other apostles, maybe more generally, but Peter directly, personally. That was premise number one. Premise number two was that Peter was the first in a line of bishops of Rome. Roman inheritance law was a factor here. The idea was that somehow or another Peter was continuing his personality, his legal personality, in the see, in the chair of Peter. By Luther's time, by and large, these premises were believed and very seldom questioned.
Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. Part two of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. Today, Luther and the Church before the Reformation. We'll talk about the papacy hitting on hard times right after this.
I chose to write about a choir director who's Lutheran and who's a big city girl but has moved to a small town.
Katie Schuerman talking about her new novel, The Choir Immortal.
I really wanted to address suffering in the present tense, this theology of the cross.
You can find out more about The Choir Immortal at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Choir Immortal by Katie Schuerman.
You might wonder, is it possible for my child with special needs to receive a rich classical Christian education? Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope answers yes. With the Simply Classical curriculum created by Cheryl and published by Memoria Press, there's no reason to withhold a beautiful education from any struggling student. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Continuing education for the Confessional Lutheran. You're listening to Issues Etc.
LutheranReformation.org is the brand new one-stop shop for all things Reformation. It's your source for news, events, history, videos, activities, educational resources, and much, much more. New resources will be added regularly, each one designed to help you celebrate and remember the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Because Reformation 2017 is still all about Jesus. Visit LutheranReformation.org today. LutheranReformation.org.
Do you have a hard time finding Christian greeting cards and gifts that aren't either sappy or theologically suspect? Ad Crucem offers the perfect combination of art and the truth of the scriptures with beautiful and reverent greeting cards and gifts. Deliver the true comfort of the gospel, Christ crucified for sinners, to family and friends with Ad Crucem. ADCRUCEM.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest, part two of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. Today we're dealing with Luther and the church before the Reformation. On the subject of the church before the Reformation, you introduced the idea of the kind of the basis for the papacy in the minds of the medieval church before the break. But it is true, and I want you to talk about this, Ken, that the papacy had already hit on hard times even before Luther came on the scene.
Yeah, the papacy had not had the last couple of centuries of the greatest time. In 1302, Pope Boniface VIII had made the strongest claim of papal authority that had yet been made. For much of the Middle Ages, Todd, popes and kings, especially the Holy Roman Emperor, kept vying back and forth for influence. For example, in a famous scene in 1077, the excommunicated Emperor Henry IV was kneeling in the snow as a penitent before Pope Gregory VII. Gregory VII, of course, had said he could depose emperors. He also said, by the way, that no council could be called without the Pope's consent. And that's a point that we will run into again. Henry presented himself as a penitent. What could the Pope do but forgive him? But then Henry came back and attacked Rome and attacked the Pope. Well, by 1302, Boniface VIII had come past a lot of that stuff, and he said, look, the Pope has not only the spiritual but the temporal sword. It resides in the church, his church, and the Pope is the head of the church. Political authority, Boniface said, is there to protect and serve the spiritual authority, not the other way around. And since there's only one God, there can only be one ultimate authority in this world. That's the church with the Pope at the head. With a flourish, Boniface's pronouncement, the bull Unum Sanctum, said it is altogether necessary for salvation for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff. The ironic thing, though, is when he said that, he had no idea what was about to happen.
What did happen?
Well, the next year, a gang of toughs who was working for a king that the Pope was threatening with excommunication, broke into the Pope's summer quarters and seized the Pope. I mean, they grabbed Boniface. The man was traumatized by this. He was at length freed, but he died a month after he was freed. So the irony here, Todd, again, is that that very year after Boniface's bold claim, the papacy was on the doorstep of a century of confusion. In 1307, the new French pope made a decision he knew was not going to go over well in Rome, so he just settled down in France, finally at Avignon. And when he died a few years later, there was a great desire to bring the papacy back to Rome, but how do you do it? They elected a 72-year-old to be the pope, figuring that he would only live for a couple of years and buy them some time to figure all this out. He lived and remained pope for 22 years. He never went back to Rome, and by this time, the papacy is pretty well established there in France.
But this, at the same time, had to basically make for a very weakened papacy, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Remember, part of the pope's claim to authority is that he's the bishop of Rome, but now he's not even in Rome. And while he was not in Rome, while the papacy was in France, in about the middle of the 14th century, 1356, the Holy Roman Emperor at the time issued a bull or pronouncement of his own, which kind of ignored all the pope's claims in electing new emperors, Boniface VIII notwithstanding. The electors were three church officials, but not the pope among them, the archbishops, rather, of Cologne, Trier, and Mainz, and four political officials, the Count Palatine, the King of Bohemia, the Margrave of Brandenburg, and the Duke of Saxony. Now, all that's going to be important for Luther later, but especially the fact that his prince, the Duke of Saxony, is one of the seven electors of the Holy Roman Emperor from there on.
When did the papacy eventually return from France to Rome? How did that happen?
Well, it happened in 1377. Pope Gregory the 11th went back, and he died the very next year in Rome. So the College of Cardinals elects a new pope to succeed him. But it didn't take them long for most of them, and most of them were French, to get dissatisfied with the successor that they had elected. And so they just chose a new pope, a French guy, who set up a rival curia in France. So now you've got two popes, one in Rome and one in France, each of them claiming legitimacy. This is called the Papal Schism. It lasted almost 40 years. And would you believe, before it was all over, for a brief time, there was even a third claimant to be pope. So you had three guys saying, I'm the pope, listen to me.
So how did all that get resolved?
Well, it got resolved by recourse to councils. A canon law was a help here in the situation. It had said for a long time that appeal could be made to a council if the pope you had turned out to be a heretic. Well, now political thinkers like Marsilio of Padua were saying that if the pope's not getting the job done, if he's not doing the job that he should, then by all means give the job to someone who will. There were various philosophical underpinnings to conciliar theory and a historical fact. Historically, some people were remembering that, you know, in the ancient church, the Bishop of Rome was in fact not always supreme. So after an unsuccessful attempt at one council, the Council of Pisa in 1409 to end this papal schism, a few years later, the more lengthy Council of Constance did effectively assert the authority of a council to settle this matter and elected a new pope. Now, here was a council, mind you, not the pope, seizing the initiative to reform the church in head and members. That's not a 16th century slogan. That's a 15th century slogan.
But I don't get the impression by the time we get to the 16th century that the pope is in any way under the thumb of the councils. When we get to Luther, it seems we have a very independent and powerful pope.
Yeah, well, things had changed. The popes in the 100 years or so between the Council of Constance and the time of Luther had been cozying up to the various kings, and it paid off. For example, the church in France managed to get a bit of independence from the pope. And the kings liked this. I mean, the kings liked the idea of dealing with only one person, not a whole council. So by 1460, the reigning pope at the time was able to put out a bull condemning conciliar theory. It hadn't been long before that that the Council of Constance had solved this whole problem. But now here's the pope saying that if you ignore him, if you ignore the vicar of Christ, the pope, and appeal to a council, that would bring about your excommunication. So I suppose you could say in sum, Todd, that by Luther's time, the conciliar movement was kind of like a fire that had been put out. And these early 16th century popes were like firemen standing by with water buckets, ready to pour on the water on any stray embers that might spark up again.
That is all kind of at the higher echelons of the church and of the government. What was church life like at this time for common people?
Well, people would confess their sins. Of course, they were supposed to confess their sins at least once a year. And it was a pretty rigorous examination. You were supposed to confess all of your sins. If you wanted them forgiven, you were supposed to confess them all. The priest would ask you very pointed questions in the confessional. The whole system of penance was conceived of as consisting really of three parts: confession, absolution, and satisfaction, through self-sacrificing deeds or prayers or things like that. See, above and beyond the guilt of your sin, the church says there's also penalties, temporal penalties for sin, and the church said these penalties have got to be endured as satisfactions. That's that third part of penance, both in this world and, if not adequately in this world, then beyond in purgatory, which was not hell, but still a horrible, painful place of purging where the Christian soul was thought to remain for a time after death instead of immediately being with Christ, like Christ says to the thief on the cross. And see, the thing was, nobody knew just how long their own time of purgation was supposed to last. So a way to work off some of these penalties would be, for example, to take a pilgrimage, like a trip to a holy shrine. Maybe take up the life of apostolic poverty in the process, go begging for food on the way. Or you could pray to the saints or venerate their relics. I mean, major churches and shrines had collected various artifacts like pieces of wood that were supposed to come from Christ's cross or fragments of bone that were supposed to come from one or another of the saints. Luther's prince, Frederick the Wise, had one of the most impressive relic collections that there was. And in all of this, the imperative constantly was, do what is in you. That's how you get the lily. That's how you avoid the sword. Do what is in you.
Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. We're in our series on Martin Luther and the Reformation, talking about Luther and the church before the Reformation. When we come back, if that's the mantra, do what is in you, how is a person supposed to get mercy?
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, Coordinator for Stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.
Christ is the one who has borne all your anxieties, has taken them into his person, every worry, and he crucified it once and for all.
Listen to chapel services live weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Here's Eric listening in Chicago. Hi, Eric. What's up?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I really encourage people to give to Issues Etc. as it's the flagship of confessional liturgical Lutheranism in the world, I'd say, on the media.
Issues Etc. is listener-supported, and you can support the flagship of confessional liturgical Lutheranism in the media by making a secure online donation at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Real Reformation Radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Pilgrim Lutheran, Santa Monica, California. Emmanuel Lutheran, Terre Haute, Indiana. Trinity Lutheran, San Angelo, Texas. Trinity Lutheran and Emmanuel Lutheran, Holloway, Minnesota. St. John Lutheran, Schaumburg, Illinois. Our Savior Lutheran, Pipestone, Minnesota. Real Lutheran Fellowship, Rochester, Minnesota. Living Word Lutheran Church, The Woodlands, Texas. St. James Lutheran, Logansport, Indiana. St. John's Lutheran, State Center, Iowa, and Trinity Lutheran, West Chicago, Illinois. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're continuing our series on Martin Luther and the Reformation with Dr. Ken Sherb. He's pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. He has a PhD in history from Ohio State University, formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Folks, Concordia University, Wisconsin is committed to lifelong Lutheran learning. They offer 50 online educational options for your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree, and they will waive the application fee when you enter the promo code ISSUES
And you can find out more by clicking Concordia University Wisconsin online at our website, issuesetc.org. Their logo is right there. Click on that and you can find out everything you need to know, issuesetc.org. Ken, before the break, you talked about that that mantra, which is do that which is in you, that was the prevailing assumption of medieval Roman Catholicism. How was a person supposed to get mercy under that system?
God demands righteousness. I mean, look at the kinds of things in the scripture that he says he wants. He wants us to love him, but our love is partial. It's not completely directed to him. We've got mixed motives. We love ourselves. He wants repentance. But the problem is, are we repenting out of fear and love of God, or are we more repenting simply because we want to save our own skin? In the terms of the time, is it contrition or is it just attrition, wanting to save my own skin? God wants faith. He wants perfect faith, without doubt, daring to follow him. In all of these things, people could only come up with partial obedience. But the church said at the time, well, it may be partial, but it is nonetheless real. It shows at least a spark of something, a spark of the divine wanting to come back together with God. So your love of family and your friends may be only a partially good deed, but it is a good deed, at least to some extent. Even repenting to save your own skin was at least something. And faith, if it's only agreeing that what the church says is right, well, that's the least you can do, so do the least you can do. The church authorities said, don't worry, the church will add sufficient grace from the treasury of merits, the excess merits of Christ and the saints, that they don't need. They can be applied to you, so your work will be accepted as good in the sight of God. Now, that would happen in confession, where satisfaction would be prescribed, and, of course, it would happen in the Mass, where you would get an infusion of grace.
It sounds like an arrangement by which the church was telling that people that God demanded righteousness but was willing to be accommodating. He was willing to meet sinful man halfway, if not more than halfway.
Yeah, well, the thought was that there was kind of a contract between God and human beings, a contract that God himself had initiated. He, after all, made this world in a particular way, placed the church into this world. Even that desire for self-preservation is something that God placed into human beings, and God has given people opportunities to serve him. So take advantage of all of these opportunities. Fulfill your part of the contract. The saying at the time was, God will not refuse grace to those who do what is in them. This was the particular way that Luther had learned as a student. It wasn't the only way people had of putting this. But for all medieval theologians, no matter who they were, the idea was basically that like attracts like. If you're going to be saved, you have to become more and more like God. God is love, so you have to cultivate the habitus, the disposition of being loving, doing these grace-assisted acts, and loving God. Grace had to come before good works, for example, Thomas Aquinas said, but the good works were what made God take pleasure in people.
But didn't the church already have, say in the case of St. Augustine, the insistence that salvation was by grace? It seems like they had departed significantly from that.
Well, Augustine did say a lot about grace, and it's a kind of a mixed bag. On the one part, he said that, you know, if it's not free, it's not grace. And that was true, and it was a great insight that he urged against the Pelagians, who had denied original sin and kind of taught a crass form of work righteousness. But by Luther's time, theology had become semi-Pelagian, and it got the impetus for that from something else that Augustine said, this time unhappily so, that grace is infused. It's not an attitude in God's heart, his favor for sinners, as much as it is kind of like a medicinal substance by which the sinner is gradually nursed to health. So the more good you do, the more God approves it and likes it, and the more grace he gives you to do still more. It's an upward trend, an upward spiral. these two points from Augustine, that grace is free and that grace is infused, stand in a kind of tension with one another. It's amazing how many people had sort of smoothed out the tension, but though by Luther's time. And when Luther got started, he believed them both.
Okay, so this kind of late medieval theological depiction of salvation, this had to have very far-reaching ramifications. What were they?
Well, in terms of the way you look at human beings, I like what Bob Kolb and Chuck Arend wrote in a book. They said, sin was considered to be mainly individual activities, like pearls on a string, you know, voluntarily done. Emotions were neither good nor bad unless they were carried out in action. You have to want to do something for it to be a sin. In theory, while it was difficult to love God with all your heart, you still could do it. People want to do the right thing, was the thought here. They simply lack information. And regarding God, I might add, in this view, what God does is he kind of modifies his expectations to meet the level of human capability.
So, again, we're kind of back to that accommodation. The formal theology that we're talking about here doesn't sound like it was the only game in town. Were there also late medieval mystics? What were the other schools of theology that were playing around in the life of the church at the time? And were they any better on issues like this?
Yeah, there were mystics. For example, Johann Tauler, who actually wrote something that Luther edited for publication. The mystics generally, no surprise here, encouraged the interior spiritual life, prayer, meditation. Pilgrimages, don't do that. That might expose you to temptations. Contemplate God's magnificence and his purity. Tauler talked about a birth of God in the inmost human soul. The thing was not outward observances, but interior spirituality, quite personal. Anything done outside you is no good. To save you, it must be done in you. Sound familiar? That's getting you right back to the kind of thing we were talking about before. Do what is in you.
What about the humanists of the Renaissance period? In particular, I'm thinking about Erasmus of Rotterdam.
Well, humanism, not to be confused with secular humanism today, was a movement marked by an overpowering interest in classical antiquity. It urged study of the original languages, Greek and Latin especially. It wanted eloquence together with wisdom. Very much opposed to scholastic method, very much interested in rhetoric. Petrarch, who was kind of the arch-humanist in Italy, said that all great religious writers were fundamentally poets, not logicians. But still, humanism as such did not oppose the accepted church theology. For example, Erasmus, whom you mentioned, for all of his learning, like he did an edition of the Greek New Testament based on the oldest Greek manuscripts that he could find, but still, he was basically into cultivating the individual human being's piety. Avail yourself of the sacraments, Erasmus would say, fine, but by all means, see to the inner life of your soul. So as with the mystics, the humanists, too, put a great insistence on the internal. That didn't rule out actions. There was a lot to do. If you want faith, Erasmus said, well, go to church, pray, give money to the needy, draw back from your vices. And another scholar observed that that was Erasmus's particular way of saying, do what is in you. I should add, Todd, one other thing the humanists did was to chip away at the credibility of the high faculties of theology. When these faculties of theology condemned Luther, a lot of people just yawned because their condemnation didn't have quite the bite that it would have had before the humanists came around.
The last time we were talking, you noted that one of the earmarks of the mature Lutheran teaching, the mature Luther himself on salvation, is alien righteousness. That's the term that you use, that we are justified and forgiven on the basis of the righteousness of another, namely Christ. Now, it sounds like not only were the scholastics not teaching this alien righteousness, but neither was anyone else, the mystics or anyone else, much less the church.
Yeah, that's right. Therefore, we have to be careful about identifying, quote-unquote, forerunners of the Reformation. I mean, there were a lot of people running around in late medieval times who criticized the church. Many criticized it on moral and ethical grounds, sometimes over various points of theology. But as Luther himself observed, when he started out, none of his opponents, none of them understood this alien righteousness.
When we come back, 10 more minutes with Dr. Ken Sherb in part two of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. Today we're talking about Luther and the church before the Reformation. Stay tuned.
Lutheran Talk.
In Lutheranism, I come as a guilty sinner in need of hearing the forgiving words of Christ every single time I gather. Every single time.
Lutheran music. The new Lutheran Public Radio app. Download for iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.
Holy Cross Lutheran Church, Moline, Illinois, invites you to join us in receiving the Lord's gifts in word and sacrament. Sunday services are at 8:15 and 10:45 a.m., with Bible class and Sunday school at 9:30 a.m. We are located in the Quad Cities at 4107 21st Avenue, Moline, Illinois. Welcome in the name of our Lord.
Quality, quantity, qualified. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe that traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
When the Apostle Paul stated, "I have become all things to all men," was he talking about fitting in with the world? I've written an article in the latest Issues, Etc. journal titled All Things to All Men. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues, Etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. You can also read Pastor David Wan's story of failing to find Lutheran theology in several Lutheran churches, but finding it in Scripture and the Lutheran Confessions, the free online Issues Etc. journal. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. 10 more minutes in our conversation with Dr. Ken Sherb in part two of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. We're talking about the church before the Reformation. In our two of Issues, Etc., Pastor Ted Giese joins us to review the movie Spectre. It's the latest in the 007 Bond films. And then we'll be doing Christ in the Old Testament today, Daniel 12, The Time of the End, with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. Ken, how would you summarize everything? We've kind of come a long ways between Luther and the church before the Reformation. How would you summarize what we've said so far?
Well, the first point I guess we made is that in the early 16th century, Martin Luther was a very intelligent young German who was on the track to a career as a lawyer. We also said that by 1500 or so, when Luther was in school, the papacy had emerged from a very unsettled and chaotic time for about the last two centuries, but it emerged fully in control of the church and the church's system of penance. And, of course, we said that Luther's mature teaching of alien righteousness was really different from everything that was being taught in Christendom at the time. Now, that's by way of just giving you a few summary statements. Let me pose, like we did last time, Todd, a few true or false statements, and you and the listeners can kind of think along with me here and ask yourself, well, is this right or not? So, first statement, true or false. Luther took his master's degree in theology. False. no one really took a master's degree in theology at the time. That's not to say that he hadn't heard any theology, hadn't read any theology, or studied any theology by the time he got his master's degree, but it was a general liberal arts degree that was designed to prepare somebody to go on and study in one of the three higher faculties, medicine, law, or theology. And, of course, he was going into law. My second statement for you, true or false. The papacy's power had been growing through the two centuries before Luther got his master's degree. It may be surprising, but that's actually false. At least in any observable way, the papacy's power had come on some hard times. There was that period, that 70-year period of the quote-unquote Babylonian captivity of the papacy, when the popes were in France, not in Rome. There was the period, almost 40 years, of the papal schism, where you had more than one claimant to be pope, and there was the conciliar movement that arose and solved that problem of the papal schism. But the conciliar movement meant that councils were now kind of a competing threat, as it were, to the authority of the pope, and the popes kind of had to watch their rear lest the conciliar movement come up again in the 16th century. Another statement, true or false. Churchmen advised Christians to do what is in you. That's true. That was even preached as a kind of a bumper sticker slogan from pulpits. And you could do what is in you through penance, through pilgrimages, through the veneration of the saints and various relics. There were all sorts of ways to do this. A related statement, true or false. In late medieval theology, doing what is in you would have been deemed worthless without an infusion of grace. And that too is true. I don't want to be pejorative here, but I saw an interesting reference by a friend of mine who talked about grace, the way grace was conceived at the time, as a performance-enhancing drug. Well, I think we can get the basic idea there. Grace was supposed to give you a kind of a shot of vim and vigor that would enable you to do still more, for which God could pat you on the head and approve of you and declare you right and righteous. Another statement. About 1,100 years before Luther, Augustine had objected to the idea of infused grace. People usually get suspicious when a date is involved. They think that somebody's trying to trip them up on the date. Well, I'm not trying to trip you up on the date. The statement is false, but it's true that Augustine lived about 1,100 years before Luther. But again, that's not the point. Augustine said two things. He said both that grace is free, and there he's just reflecting what the Bible says in a passage like Romans 11:6. If it is by grace, then it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. So grace is free, but grace is also infused. It's that substance that enables you to do more, be more. Final statement, true or false. The mystics and humanists differed from the scholastic theologians on the infusion of grace and doing what is in you. False. The mystics and the humanists differed from the scholastics in a lot of ways, but on this point, which was kind of the bottom line to it all, they came to a very similar place, and you could sum up also what they said with the saying, do what is in you, even if they didn't apply it as rigorously to their own theology as a self-description as, say, the scholastics did.
A couple of curious questions I have for you here in the last few minutes. We will be talking in the next installment and beyond about the struggles that Luther begins to have, spiritual struggles, with these very truths. Is there any indication that before, while he's still on track to become a lawyer, this brilliant young student, that he is in any way struggling with these things? Does any of his autobiographical reflections tell us that he was struggling with these issues of the theology at the time?
Not so much in his earlier years as a student, although, as we'll have occasion to kind of trace in a little bit of detail next time, He is, by the time he gets his master's degree there in early 1505, really thinking about, well, his whole career path, but related to that is the subject of his soul's salvation. And, of course, he takes a very different career path. After he's only been in law studies for about a month, he gives it all up, and he goes into a monastery.
The other thing is, it sounds as though this "do what is in you" presents at first glance, at the, on the surface, a very, as we've said, very accommodating God who's willing to meet you more than halfway. And yet I'm wondering if that is just kind of the velvet glove over the iron fist, because in the end what Luther discovers is beneath that velvet glove of "do what is in you" is still a God who demands obedience in order to be pleased with you. Talk a bit about that, if you would, in the last few minutes.
Well, I think you said it very well right there. The law is always going to be a treadmill for us. We're never going to get ahead. We'll always be falling behind. What we do is never enough, and what we have done is not good enough. So by way of quantity or quality, works done under the law will never suffice to be the sinner's basis on which to stand before God.
You said that you know, when Luther actually comes to his epiphany, he realizes that none of these other medieval Roman schools of theology departed from that, "do what is in you." Were there others who were equally concerned as Luther with, as you just said, that kind of treadmill of works, merit, and the law?
Well, there are people who begin to emerge roughly the time that Luther does. For example, you have Zwingli in Switzerland, who begins to preach in a kind of a Reformation vein at, well, roughly the time Luther posts the 95 Theses, actually about a year and a half or so later. So, yeah, there are others coming around. And there's a bit of debate back and forth still between Reformation historians about how much influence there was back and forth. Zwingli, for example, said, "No, I got all this myself. I didn't pick up any of this from Luther." And people will debate. And frankly, I don't know. It kind of depends on what side of the bed I get up on a given day, you know, how much of the early theology of Zwingli he got from Luther. But the fact is, as we'll say in another couple of times, Luther became quite a cause célèbre there in Europe at the time. People heard about him, and they heard about him far beyond the places where he traveled. So there could have been influence.
So with about a minute here, give us a little preview of what we're going to talk about next time.
Well, next time we're going to begin in the tracing of Luther's struggles, as you say, with the theology of his time, the spirituality of his time. And driving this is a concern for his own salvation. Luther is really animated by the idea of the care of souls, the objective of the care of souls, starting with his own. So next time we're going to be tracing Luther through the time when he becomes an Augustinian friar and a priest in his early days as a professor at the University of Wittenberg. The time after that, we'll talk about the important year, 1517, especially the 95 Theses on Indulgences. The time after that will be 1518, and the star of the show there will be Luther's Heidelberg Disputation. And then we'll kind of put a bow on it, hopefully, and look back from the perspective of about 1519 over all of Luther's development to that point.
Dr. Ken Cherb is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. He has a Ph.D. in history from Ohio State University and served as a theology professor at Concordia University, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Kim, I look forward to next time's conversation.
We'll talk then.
In hour two of Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon, Pastor Ted Giese will join us. We'll be reviewing the movie Spectre, the latest in the Bond films. Then Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will join us for our regular weekly series, Christ in the Old Testament. Daniel 12 will be the passage we're looking at, the time of the end. That's all in hour two of Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. book of the month for November is actually a novel. It's by Issues Etc. regular guest Katie Schuerman. It's the second in a series of novels that she's written. This one's called The Choir Immortal, a very honest, real look at life in a Lutheran parish. The center of the novel, of course, the forgiveness of sins in Jesus Christ. You'll enjoy it. You can order it, especially as a Christmas gift, called The Choir Immortal, The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for November. Just give Concordia Publishing House a call, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Hour two of Issues, Etc. is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hollywood's attitude toward Christianity, the Bible's influence on the U.S. Constitution, the decline of biblical preaching, the connection between biblical illiteracy and Western morality. You'll find these essays and more in the new book, The Word They Still Shall Let Remain, The Place of the Holy Scriptures in the Faith and Life of Confessional Lutherans. Check it out at shop.logia.org. The Word They Still Shall Let Remain, shop.logia.org.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
We have 7 Arabic language transcripts of Issues, Etc. that you can download for free.
يمكنك تنزيل النص لسبع حلقات من برنامج قضايا باللغة العربية مجانا.
These broadcast transcripts cover the 6 chief parts of Luther's Small Catechism and include a teaching on why do bad things happen.
تغطي تلك النصوص الأجزاء الستة الرئيسية من كتاب التعليم المسيحي لمارتن لوثر.
You can download and print these Arabic transcripts for free. Just go to issuesetc.org, click publications.
وتشمل تعليما عن لماذا تحدث المصائب. لتنزيل وطباعة النصوص العربية مجانا اذهب إلى issuesetc.org ثم انقر على publications.
Casting Christ's net on the internet, issuesetc.org.
نطرح شبكة المسيح على شبكة الإنترنت. issuesetc.org.